we can project ourselves on some real or imaginary concept of humanity that is better than we are. You know, when I travel in Muslim countries, people will always go the extra mile for me. You know, they'll buy me a Sprite or put me on their motorbike and ride me around, and I'll say, oh, you don't have to do that. Oh, yes, Mr. William, we do, you know, because it's our religion to help the guest. And I think, well, what a great religion.
Yes. You know? Of course, Christianity, I think, started that way, too. I don't know if it's still like that. But
yeah, sometimes it is. You know, I've met lots of really nice Christians, too. But anything, you know, that inspires us to be better than we normally would be is a good thing, you know. And part of the lucky star, you know, one reason that it's not just a completely dark and gloomy book, the way How You Are is that as Neva's disciples start realizing that they can never get enough of her, and she, you know, like Jesus, is starting to wear out, then they realize, well, they do have each other. And some of them, you know, can actually make a difference to themselves and each other by trying to love whoever is in front of them. And, you know, if there were a divine Jesus or even a historical Jesus, I'm sure that's what he would want us to do.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Lucky Star, from Viking Press. And there is some redemption in the book. I mean, the character Judy herself, the transgender woman, and even her boyfriend, the retired policeman, you call him throughout the book.
Right, yeah. He just seems like such a horrible, hateful person.
And he can be at times.
He can be.
Violent, and abusive.
Right. And Judy seems, you know, so messed up and really the author of her own misery so much of the time. And then after a while, through a lot of help from others in this so-called community that she has, she begins to realize that she actually likes what she is and who she is. And maybe she's not a woman or a man, but something different. And then he at some point, you know, starts admitting, yeah, that he's probably gay and that, you know, and that he loves her. And so if people are doing what they want to do, it's not so terrible. You know, one time I was in San Francisco and I went to this S&M seminar on the infliction of pain and terror. So the dominant and submissive were both women. The dominant was nailing parts of the other woman to a table.
Oh, my.
Setting parts of her on fire.
And this is all consensual.
Yeah, but there was crime scene tape around it. There was one old guy walking around it, chuckling, and the submissive was screaming. And it was like, it was horrendous. You know, it was like watching some kind of atrocity. They said, once the scene starts, you're not allowed to leave until the break. And then after the break, we're going to talk about what you've just seen. So I stuck around, and after the break, the submissive said, those were orgasmic screams. Ah. I was having the time of my life, and this is exactly what I planned out. I wanted all these specific things to happen to me, and it was just such a wonderful experience for me. And I thought, well, okay. I don't have to like doing that or having it done to me, but if two adults like it, then who am I to say?
Right, consensual. And Judy's a bit like that. There's a lot of things done to her that I don't think any of us would like.
That's right.
But she does get pleasure from that and feels it's even a loving gesture on the part of the retired policeman, her partner.
That's right, and so then it is. About halfway through the book, I was really, really blocked. And I thought it would be too easy, you know, to make it end like How You Are. I've been there and done that. Let's try and actually make this a little bit helpful, a little bit inspiring to the extent that Mr. Gloom and Doom can do it. And I was up in Seattle and I was talking to these two young lesbians who were very, very helpful. And they said, I just don't know, you know, what I can do for Judy. And one of them said, well, tell me about her. I said, well, you know, she's kind of like me. She's old, a little fat, pretty ugly, doesn't look too good in a dress. She's probably not super smart, you know, and in a way, she's kind of a disgusting person. A lot of people think of her as disgusting. And one of the women said, well, then all she has to do is embrace her inner disgustingness. And that's what I do.
And there's a part where she tries out for a strip club.
Right.
And on her second attempt, she's very successful. The first one's a complete failure.
Right.
Because she accepts her disgustingness. Or
that's right. And I thought, like, what a great thing. Like, how liberating. And, you know, and one of the things I really love about a lot of these young trannies and genderqueer people and you name it is that they don't care how people look at them, and they're going to be out front and bold and defiant and just creating a new self. And for me, like, what could be more American, you know? Walt Whitman would probably go for it, you know, or Thomas Wolfe, you know, America's the place where anyone can create his own destiny. Why
right.
not, you know?
Now, I actually have in the next question something about that. You're not just in the book, you're not just exploring the themes of divinity and celebrity, but you also explore identity in the book, accepting yourself for who you are. If you're disgusting, accept that you're disgusting, I guess. It's a big issue, of course, with, you mentioned Judy, with transgender women, not just the character Judy. She was born as a male named Frank. She always felt she was a woman.
And she was Frank because if Judy Garland had been a boy, they would have called her Frank.
And her Judy Garland's father was named Frank. And
yeah.
I didn't know it, but when I did the research for here, the interview, he was gay.
Right, yeah.
Really,
or bi or something, yeah.
Yeah. Frank, and her original name was not Frank, it was Francis.
That's
Francis
right.
Gum.
Yeah.
So close enough. In an essay you wrote on the Book of Dolores, you say, I had already reached adolescence before I realized that my nature could scarcely be changed. Hence, I might as well accept myself. At once, I felt relief. I could not be like others. Very well, I need not try. Strange to say, I then began to be liked. And since then, I have been blessed with as many loyal, loving friends as I could wish. So you could definitely relate to these characters' point of view. You don't have to be a transgender woman. You could be somebody who may have had a difficult childhood, or I don't know, people at school were making they made fun of me, and
right.
You know, and then you just feel, well, maybe I'm not fitting in. You know, what's wrong with me? But once you accept that you are who you are, it seems to have less of an effect, a power over you.
I think so. And why it is that I couldn't see that in Judy's case, since I'd sort of worked it out for me that I was always going to be an oddball and other people would just have to deal with it, but I couldn't. And then as soon as that young woman said that, you know, just she needs to embrace her inner disgustingness, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's what I've kind of done.
We all have it.
Yeah, we all have it. Right.
There's nobody who's not a little bit disgusting.
That's right, yeah. And then if you say, actually, yeah, this is who I am, then it's not even disgusting anymore some of the time.
Yeah, and I've read many interviews with you where you don't even pay attention to reviews. Bad review, you say you might feel bad for a few minutes. A good review, you might feel good for a few minutes, but it doesn't change the fact whether the work that they're reviewing is good or bad.
Right, because otherwise, how terrible that would be that I had no power over whether I was an attractive person or whether my books were any good. I'd rather say, yeah, let me just blame myself for all the deficiencies, and if I'm able to please myself, then be satisfied and not worry about what anyone else says. And that's why I'm a millionaire today.
After last week, I don't know, you might want to check your 401k.
That's right, yeah.
Now, most of Neva's apostles, and those are the crowd that frequents the Y Bar in San Francisco Tenderloin, are female, and they include what you describe in the book. You actually have a definition in a footnote. T-girls, so those are transgender women like the characters Judy. There's also a black transgender woman named Chantel in the book. G-girls, which stands for genetic girls, and that's a woman born into a female body.
Right.
and then L girls or lesbians. And you do an amazing job, at least for me, of getting inside their heads and thoughts. Very convincing.
Thank you.
And part of that, I know, comes from your own experiences becoming Dolores for the first two books in the trilogy, and part from a lot of research. And you already mentioned some of that research, talking to the two lesbian women in Seattle. So how'd you go about that? Did you do quite a bit, you know, hanging out in the bars like the Y Bar and talking to lesbians like the women in Seattle?
Yeah, you know, and it's that 6 degrees of separation thing. If you're looking for, you know, a certain kind of person, somebody you know knows somebody who knows somebody who's going to know the person you want to talk to. You know, in my work as a journalist, too, I go to different places. And so I visited Las Vegas several times for different reasons. And so I got to interview a couple of really amazing older lesbians there who really helped me. And then there were some younger women of different ages. You know, some were activists, some weren't. And it was quite a thrill to get to talk to them and say, you know, look, this is who I am. This is how I experience my gender and, you know, my sexual desire and so forth. And this is what I think about people who are not like me. And would you be willing to talk to me about this stuff for my novel? So otherwise, I'll never be able to know. But I can take your words and put them in someone else's head, you know, like a good appropriator, as
and
they
most,
say now.
Most of the people you asked cooperated with you then?
Yeah, everybody was really, really nice. Now, whether they'll all like the Lucky Star, I can't say. You know, I sent the ones whose addresses I had. I had Viking send them copies. And, you know, the thing about this book, with many of my books, is, you know, there's a lot of irony in it and a lot of nuance. And so if you like the equivalent of socialist realism, let's say, whereas, you know, every lesbian has to be like this very pure and noble victim who becomes a heroine, yeah, then you might not like this.
Yeah, very unrealistic.
Yeah, that's not how people are.
Right.
Yeah, but I try to make everybody as human and worthy of love and compassion as I could.
Have that's you heard back from any of the people you sent books to? Or
not yet.
Not yet.
No. Yeah.
It's early.
It's still early.
The book's
yeah.
only been out about 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
In addition to you know, this empathy that you felt for the characters and got inside their heads, there was an epigraph. I think it was an epigraph. It was a piece of Natalie Wood's acting advice, and you quote that in the book. She said, "You try to find in yourself the essence of someone else's feelings." And in the book of Dolores, you also you describe yourself not just as a writer but as an empath. So these things come easier for you to kind of get into somebody's head. I feel a little bit of it sometimes too.
Yeah, and, you're an empathetic person for sure.
Yeah, and it generally is a bad. Well, I can't say it's a bad thing, but if you know the world in its current state, maybe all of us are empaths. You know, I feel it. I feel the stress. I feel the pain.
Right.
Are you like that too? Do you?
Sure. Yeah. To be, you know, very empathetic is probably maladaptive, unless you're a psychopath, you know, who can use your empathetic intuition to manipulate others. And then that's probably a very, very adaptive way to be, you know, some sort of emotional predator.
Wow.
Who can,
yes.
You know, just think of some of the political leaders we see.
And some of the serial killers in history.
Yeah.
They were very charming sociopaths. They used that, I guess, what they knew about others or felt about others to control them and in some cases kill them.
That's right, yeah. Goering was supposedly a really, really charming guy. And, you know, at Nuremberg, apparently, he even charmed one of the American jailers into giving him poison so he didn't have to be hanged.
Ah, that's how it happened.
Yeah.
Huh.
You know, that's pretty good after all the charges against him.
Yeah. Yes. Now, given all the diversity of female characters, and we talked about, you know, the T-girls, G-girls, L-girls, and you chose a heterosexual male, a character named Richard, as your narrator, or pretty much, I think, the exclusive narrator. he has a fondness for rum and soda pop, so we kind of know.
Yeah, he probably does not have very good teeth.
No. And he's part of that Y Bar crowd and one of Neva's apostles. So his account reads something like almost a New Testament gospel. Were you thinking of that, like kind of Matthew,
sure,
Luke, John, writing about their acquaintance with Jesus as apostles?
Yeah, something like that. And oftentimes, well, you know, the story is so preposterous anyway. But one of the many preposterous elements is that, you know, Richard, who just lives in his head, like me.
And I thought there was a little bit of you in him.
Yeah, that's right. Although maybe he's a little more far gone than I am. But then he'll start telling us what's happening inside of the hearts and minds of all of these people who are with Neva when he's not,
yes,
even there.
I didn't quite get that. I didn't know if you had switched all of a sudden to a third-person omniscient rather than Richard, but you didn't.
That's
he,
right.
He just kind of, well, maybe he's empathic. You know, he
maybe
just knows,
he is, yeah.
And psychic, because he knows what's going on even though he's not there.
Right. And, you know, it's sort of ambiguous in the book. You can never be sure whether actually he knows or whether he's saying, well, yeah, this is the legend, you know, this is the gospel,
yes,
I'm going to write.
Right.
So
that's why all four gospels are different.
Quite different, yeah, that's right. And when Neva or Karen first goes to the island to become Neva, you know, he's saying, well, in her legend, this is what seemed to happen. And then, you know, the retired policeman saying, what are you talking about? That's all baloney.
Right. He likes his data.
That's right, yeah. And the retired policeman, in a way, is the only sane one because...
he's the most rational, it seems.
Yeah, he just refuses to believe in things that don't add up. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't add up, right? That Neva goes to this island and then suddenly preserves her youth for decades, and somehow she has this sealskin pouch with infinite money in it.
$100 bills,
yeah,
just magically appear for her.
Right. It's just so stupid. How could that possibly be true?
But that's true with a lot of the Gospels, huh? Unless,
right,
you have the faith.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
I mean, they make no sense rationally.
Right. And in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Gibbon said something like, you know, the test of faith is believing something that seems absolutely incredible to the profane mind. And he has the profane mind.
Now, I was also interested, Richard's the narrator. Did you pick him rather than a female? Because it's kind of somewhat of a stand-in for you as a way of kind of comment. I mean, in some of your books, you intrude as William the Blind, a,
right,
character, certainly in the Seven Dreams series, and where you become the narrator, in effect. And here, I know you identify at least a little with Richard. Is that why you picked him, a male, rather than one of the female characters?
You know, in any sort of artistic endeavor, it's important to know when to stop. If you read Euripides, and there are mentions of gods and goddesses, they might even appear in the play, but they don't say much. And they're enigmatic and quiet because, after all, how could we get into their heads, right?
Uh-huh.
If we were to write something, you know, from the perspective of a goddess, you know, and some people do, it's a very, very difficult thing to pull off, to start off by making everything so alien. And, you know, the situation in here is already kind of alien. And I thought, there's only so far that I'd better push myself. If I start with, you know, a male heterosexual narrator, someone kind of like me, and I can then imagine how I would feel about Neva, that's a way of helping me to get into that story.
Ah.
And if I were going to write, say, from a lesbian perspective, I probably better do another couple years of research with lesbians to get everything right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not there yet. You know, I can make up convincing prostitute characters now after many years of hanging out with the real ones. But I don't feel yet that I could invent a lesbian character out of whole cloth. I think that would take much more work.
So these lesbian characters are composites of the people you met and interviewed?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so they're often saying and doing things that I saw them saying and doing. And so that's easy.
There's some dialogue that just seemed to me that you took notes while you were in a bar.
Of course.
And yeah, you got it down exactly right.
Yeah, that's what I have to do, because right, otherwise I'll never get it. And that's one of the weird things. What is plagiarism? What's appropriation? And I figure...
Oh, especially now.
Yeah,
yes.
It's better to plagiarize and appropriate than to make up something that you can't make up on your own very well.
Now, even with Richard as the narrator, sometimes there's an authorial intrusion, breaking the fourth wall. I think the most striking is when it's about two-thirds of the way through the book, and I know you know what I'm going to be talking about here. You got a note from your editor at Viking, and you actually put it in the text, and right in the story, right in the narrative. The note reads, "To be honest," and this is coming from the editor, "I do wonder whether some readers will simply tire of, for example, all the climaxing in the book, of all the descriptions of sex acts. Does that end up having a bit of a deadening / boring effect?"
That's right. What a good question, right?
Right. But why did you include that in the book itself rather than, say, the afterword, which is extremely candid and transparent about the writing of the book?
Because I think that's actually a perfect issue to address in the middle of the text. Some people are going to say, boy, look, here's this one scene. There's a woman coming in to have sex with Neva, and she says, oh, I'm so sorry, it's my period. And then the next one comes in, and it's her period. And suddenly you start thinking, gosh, it must be kind of dreary for Neva, hearing the same things, having to do the same things with all these people. Each one has his or her own fetish. And
she satisfies them all.
Right.
Customizes her sex to what they're looking for.
Right. And other things, too. She has to be Judy's therapist and babysitter. She has to help out the retired policeman. She does all kinds of things that are really, really tiring. And so why not? Yeah, of course, sometimes all the sexual stuff is deadening, but not always. To me, like any human behavior, it's quite interesting to look at a lot of people doing something kind of similar and kind of different, and to just say, well, why are they doing that? What does that say about them? What does it say about me? And so in that sense, it doesn't matter whether it's sex or whether it's economics. It's human, so it's fascinating.
But sex is probably the perfect activity for making that exploration.
Well,
it's something that we all do, but differently, and we all have different fantasies and different desires.
That's right. Did you ever read any of the Marquis de Sade?
You had mentioned that in a recent podcast, the book, and once I listened to that, and yes, and I know you were saying, okay, we got to consider the source.
Right.
He was this guy locked up in a jail, and this is all he had, probably masturbating and writing all these sex acts. I mean, he had, 120 days of Sodom, which
right,
was pretty much one sex act after another.
That's right.
More different, each one more different, more gruesome than the next. So you were kind of thinking of that a little while you were putting all these sex acts together
for Neva? A little bit, yeah. I remember, I think the first long book I read by de Sade was Juliet.
Oh, yes.
And it had that kind of feeling, at first, especially, for, a young man like me, it was very titillating. And then I really enjoyed the crazy, eloquent speeches of the libertines explaining why this is nature's plan and uh-huh, all the rest. And then after a while, okay, all right, I think I've seen this orgy before and that orgy before, and it really is kind of dreary. And yet you still think, okay, let's keep reading and find out, what's going to happen. Like, I feel that way sometimes, when I look at parts of the Bible, Numbers, Deuteronomy, give me a break. What dreary, cruel, awful stuff. Oh, you want to keep your bondservant a little longer, so nail his ear to the door.
Ah, yes, you know, a lot of violence.
All that kind of stuff. You know, but then there will be some really beautiful thing in, oh, I don't know, in Proverbs or, I don't know, Matthew's probably my favorite of the Gospels. And so why not, you know, accept that sort of experience?
I think I found the sex in your book similar. Some was dreary and repetitive, and then I think I found some erotic.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And I feel the same way about Desaad.
Yeah, yeah.
Though I think you had more of a point in what you were doing than him.
That's right.
I think he was just entertaining himself while he was locked up, and more or less.
I think so, too, yeah.
You have some higher aspirations in your novels.
Yeah, I want to contribute to your home life. Yeah.
Now, The Lucky Star, as we mentioned, takes place in San Francisco in this Tenderloin district where the Y Bar is. And you're very familiar with that part of the city, going back to the Rainbow Stories in 1989, which I think was your second book.
That sounds right, yeah.
I find you both a scribe and a poet of San Francisco. I mean, it was a love letter to the city, but a realistic one. And I kept looking up places like the Ready Hotel. Some of them exist, and some you made up.
Right.
The streets you didn't. I mean, and I know San Francisco, not as well as you, but I know San Francisco. So I was wondering what you found. It's a changing city. You know, it's becoming gentrified with the high-tech folks, more and more expensive to live there. How has the Tenderloin changed for you since the Rainbow Stories 1989 to the Lucky Star, which is circa 2015?
Well, yeah, the Tenderloin and the Mission, you know, are not as menacing late at night. In some ways, they're better, kinder places. A lot of immigrants have moved in. In the Tenderloin, you know, I've seen people from India cycle in, people from Cambodia, so forth. And suddenly you see little Asian kids playing, you know, and outside at night on the sidewalk, which is kind of nice. But, you know, the Tenderloin, you know, was always sort of the little... haven for vice, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And it's unlike, say, New York, San Francisco is contained and constrained by water. And so when you go from one area into another, the boundary is very, very sharp because it doesn't have room to spread out. Mm-hmm. And so when you go in and out of the hard places of the Tenderloin, you feel the change in about half a block. It's quite interesting. And having gone out with
Just a block or so from Union Square, which is this big tourist place.
That's right, yeah. And I went out with the Vice Squad for Rainbow Stories, and they told me, yeah, you know, we can't erase it, so all we can do is contain it, so we make sure it has to stay in this particular area.
Ah, so what goes in that area is okay. It's like this demilitarized zone or something.
Kind of like that, yeah. So there's still... a little bit of that feeling, you know, that certain things will happen in the Tenderloin that won't happen elsewhere. But also, there are more techies and other relatively high-income people who have really changed the character of San Francisco. And so you might see some of these people come into a place like the Y Bar.
And they do in the book.
Yeah, and just to slum it.
There's several people who don't seem like they quite belong in there. And
right, yeah. So in a way, to me, that makes the feeling of those places a little bit more sad, you know, to have these rich visitors, you know, who are talking about churning out
some great dialogue in there, but there, yeah, that biz speak.
Yeah. yeah, that's all verbatim.
I was thinking that was true. It just seemed so perfect.
Yeah,
and I was in the business world for a while, so I mean, that's how we talked.
Yeah, that's right. And it's more that way all the time. It's so crazy now. This,
especially in San Francisco, yeah. With the high tech.
Right. So I would say the way that it's changed, you know, is that it's a little bit more under threat. And if there were a place like the Y Bar, it probably would be struggling. It would have to compromise. And of course, it would want, you know, the rich Germans or the rich millennials or whoever to come there so it could raise the price of the drinks. And then that would squeeze out
the people who can't afford those prices.
Yeah, Neva's regulars, yeah.
Right. Well, Bill Volman, it's always a great pleasure and joy for me to talk with you.
Oh, likewise, my friend.
Yeah, I always look forward to it. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
We've been talking with William T. Volman, author of the new novel, The Lucky Star, from Viking Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Bill for visiting us at KBOO and to all of you for listening.
Tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Esta es una sección especial en español.